This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Allahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wa salatu wa salamu ala nabiyya al-kareem wa ala alihi wa sahabi ajma'in. Firstly, want to thank each and every one of you for attending today for what will hopefully be the first of many Friday night discussions on a variety of interesting topics. And I wanted to start this year with a discussion on one of my favorite scholars, a scholar who I think is greatly misunderstood, right? And that is Imam Al-Bukhari, rahimahullah. Because Imam Al-Bukhari is one of those scholars who most people don't even know anything about him beyond the fact that he wrote the book Sahih Al-Bukhari, right? If you had to ask the average person what they know about Imam Al-Bukhari, it's really just one line. He wrote Sahih al-Bukhari. And I think it's blocking us from understanding a lot of who he was and what he accomplished by just focusing on one thing only. So today, inshallah, we're going to take a look at who Imam al-Bukhari was, the world he was born into, the kinds of people he had to deal with. We will look at his legacy, the trials he had to face, and we will also look at the various books that he wrote. Because again, many of us, we think he wrote only one book. In reality, Imam Bukhari wrote many books, and at least 10 of them are still around. So we have a lot to look at, and before we begin, just raise your hands if you ever tried reading Sahih Bukhari, a translation of it on your own. Right? Raise your hands if you understood it. Right? Okay, good. So we're all on the same page here. Right? Because one of the main points I'm going to focus on today is that Sahih al-Bukhari is a very advanced work written by a genius. So when a genius writes, he doesn't write on the average person's level. There's like layers upon layers of deep meaning in Sahih al-Bukhari. So we're going to take a look at the man behind it. Once you understand who Imam al-Bukhari was, when he lived, what was the challenges he was dealing with, why he wrote his books, why he wrote in the style that he wrote, then the way Bukhari is written, the way it's organized, the kinds of hadith he chose for it, everything makes a lot more sense when you understand his life story. So to begin, let's take a look at the time in which Imam al-Bukhari lived. Imam al-Bukhari lived in a world completely different from the one we live in. Who can guess in what era he lived in terms of dynasty? Which dynasty was ruling the Muslim world at the time of Imam al-Bukhari? Not the Umayyads, no. The Abbasids, right. So Imam al-Bukhari, he was born during the Abbasid era. More specifically, he was born during the Islamic Golden Age, the Golden Age of the Abbasid Caliphate. To put this into context, today we live in a time where Muslims are humiliated. We live in a time where Muslims are a minority in non-Muslim lands. And even in the Muslim lands, we are weak politically. There's no Muslim land we look at today and say they're going through a golden age, right? At the time in which Imam al-Bukhari was born, Muslims were the dominant civilization on earth. They were the number one superpower on earth. Muslims were the richest, the most scientifically advanced, and the greatest society in the world at that time. So it's a very different world from the world that we live in. And even the sciences of Islamic studies, they all peaked around this time. So in this era, in the Abbasid golden era, we get, for example, we have Imam Shafi'i, he lives during this era. Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, he lives during this era. So the great Imams of Fiqh, they live during this period. The great Imams of Hadith, they live during this period. The great Imams of Aqidah live during this time. So all of the Islamic sciences that we know today, they were shaped in this period, the Abbasid Golden Age. And a lot of people, they they don't realize that. When they think of the Abbasid Golden Age, they think of science, they think of algebra, they think of medicine, and they don't realize that at the same time when Muslims were world leaders in those fields, they also reached their peak in terms of scholarship in these fields. So the science of hadith, one of the misconceptions people have, is that Imam Bukhari wrote the first book of hadith. Now you always hear this misconception. The hadith pops up 300 years after the Prophet's time. In reality, hadith is there in every generation. And the writing of hadith begins in the Umayyad era, in the year 99 AH, the reign of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, where he commissions a project for hadith to be recorded into books. This project, it builds up over time. Over the next 200 years, each generation of scholars are writing books of hadith that are more advanced and more detailed than the generation before them. And this peaks 200 years later with Imam al-Bukhari. So Imam al-Bukhari is not the first author of a book of hadith. He is the pinnacle of hadith scholarship, building on the backs of many scholars that came before him. So it's a time when Muslims are a global superpower. They had defeated the Persian Empire completely. They had destroyed a lot of the Roman Empire and taken over many of their lands. And at this point in time, there is a kind of peace between the Romans and the Muslims, right? An uneasy peace, on and off. And there's no civil wars at this time either. So we know in the first century, there's a lot of civil wars. In the first century, we have the civil wars between the Sahaba. Then we have the Umayyads against Abdullah ibn Zubayr. But after the Abbasids take over, about 50 years, 100 years later, which is the period we're looking at now, this is a time where there's not really any civil wars going on. It's also a time where Muslims are very wealthy. Money is not a problem, right? Muslims are the wealthiest nation on earth. Resources, not a problem. You want to study hadith, you have the best hadith scholars. You want to study fiqh, we have the best fiqh scholars. You want to study medicine or algebra, Baitul Hikmah is there. You can go and study at the actual research center set up by the Khalifa himself. So it's a very different world from what we live in. And it's important for us to understand that because Imam Bukhari lived in a different world from us, he wrote for his time to deal with the challenges of his time, which are very different from the challenges of our time. So what were the challenges of the Golden Age? I want you to think about this. If Muslims were wealthy, they were the global superpower, they did not have any enemies who were invading them in a way where they were threatened to lose their empire, they had whatever they needed, what do you think was the big problem of that time? The actual big problem of that time was disunity. Argumentation over secondary and what we would consider trivial issues. People had a lot of time on their hands. So people were arguing, you know, the words that come out of my mouth, are they created or not? Now these are the kind of arguments people were having. What is the definition of taqdeer, of destiny, right? Lots of opinions, people fighting each other over that. Raising your hands before and after ruku, big issue in that time, as we will see when we do Imam Bukhari's biography. So Imam al-Bukhari, he writes his book to respond to all of these issues. And for him, living in that time, these are the big issues of the time. People are arguing over aqidah, people are arguing over fiqh. They didn't really need to worry too much about outsiders. They didn't worry about what non-Muslims were saying about Islam, right? The non-Muslims were in a position of humiliation at that time, right? They were scared of the Muslims. They wouldn't dare go and write a book criticizing the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam because the Muslims were the dominant superpower. So it's a very different time with very different challenges. And many of the issues that you're going to see that Imam Bukhari brings up and discusses and considers like important topics are things that today are already resolved. We've already learned to accept the differences of opinion. And where we think of it maybe as trivial issues because in his lifetime these issues popped up and everybody was heated about it. 1,000 years later, we've got bigger problems to deal with, right? We don't have a khilafat, we are minorities, we have much deeper and bigger issues to deal with. So Imam al-Bukhari was born in a time that was perfect for the job that he ended up doing. The family he was born into is also very interesting. Imam al-Bukhari was a fourth generation Muslim. So it was his great-grandfather, Mughira, who converted to Islam, right? Mughira had a son named Ibrahim. We don't know anything about Ibrahim. There's nothing that we can find about him in the history books. Ibrahim had a son named Ismail, who was a merchant, quite a wealthy merchant, and who also did do some hadith. He memorized some hadith, he wrote them down, he passed them along. So we begin to see hadith coming into the family with Ismail. And he has a son who we know as Imam al-Bukhari. Now, the father of Imam al-Bukhari, he passes away at a very young age. And Imam al-Bukhari is raised by a single mother. And this whole thing about him having a merchant father and being raised by a single mother, it all plays a very important role in who he becomes. There's one interesting fact here on history at this point. Imam al-Bukhari is like the third famous scholar in a row with almost the exact same backstory. So Imam al-Shafi, his father dies when he is young. His mother dedicates her life to her son becoming a scholar, and he becomes Imam al-Shafi. Imam al-Shafi has a student, Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal. His life story is exactly the same. His father dies when he is young. His mother dedicates her life to her son becoming a scholar, and he dedicates his life to her as well. Like, he only gets married at the age of 40 because he was too busy looking after his mother to actually get married, right? And he becomes the great Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal. And then Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal has a student, Imam al-Bukhari, and his story is the same. His father dies when he's young. His mother dedicates her life to raising him to become a scholar, and he becomes Imam al-Bukhari. So three teachers in a row have almost the exact same life story, in the sense that they were raised by single mothers who had one vision for their life: my son must become a scholar. And it is from the vision of their mothers and the tarbiyah that their mothers gave them that they became these great scholars of Islam. So Imam al-Bukhari is someone who was very, very devoted to his mother, right? In this book of his that I'm going to talk about a bit later, Adab al-Mufrad, the first 10 chapters is on the rights of the mother. Literally the first 10 chapters is just the rights of the mother. Now you can just see the level of devotion he had to his mother and how important he has this idea of the mother's status in Islam from the writings of Imam al-Bukhari. So just very briefly, let's go through his technical aspects. His kunya was Abu Abdullah. His name was Muhammad. Many people think his name is Bukhari, right? Where does the name Bukhari come from? Where he lived. Good, right? Bukhara. He was born in the city of Bukhara. So wherever you went, people will say it's that guy from Bukhara. Or in Arabic, you'll say it's Bukhari, right? Bukhari means the guy from Bukhara. So he became known as the guy from Bukhara, the Bukhari, right? But his name was actually Muhammad. Muhammad ibn Ismail, right? We said his father's name was Ismail. So he's Muhammad ibn Ismail ibn Ibrahim ibn al-Mughira ibn Bardizba al-Jufi al-Bukhari. Now, interestingly, his great-great-grandfather's name is Bardizba. Bardizba was a Zoroastrian, a Persian Zoroastrian. It is Bardizba's son Mughira who converts to Islam. So this shows us that Imam al-Bukhari is not an Arab. Many people don't know this. Imam al-Bukhari was not an Arab. He was a Persian, right? His great-great-grandfather was a Zoroastrian. His great-grandfather converted to Islam. So he's a fourth-generation Persian Muslim, right? Remember, Persia back then was much bigger than what we imagine it. So what is today Uzbekistan and Iraq and Iran and all of these lands were one country called Persia, right? So he was born in the city of Bukhara, which in the modern world is in Uzbekistan. And he passed away also in Uzbekistan, but in a small village outside Samarkand. So if you go to Uzbekistan today, you will find his grave in the small village, but you'll also find that Bukhara is a famous place because it's where he was born. We have very specific details about his birth and death, right? He was born on Friday, the 21st of July, 810 CE, corresponding with 13th of Shawwal, 194 AH. Very specific, right? He passed away on the 1st of September, 870, corresponding with the 1st of Shawwal, 256. That will make him 60 according to the Gregorian calendar and 62 according to the Hijri calendar. What's interesting about him passing away at the age of 62? The Prophet ﷺ passed away at the age of 62. Abu Bakr passed away at the age of 62. Umar radiallahu anhu, some say 61, some say 62. Aisha radiallahu anha passed away at the age of 62. So almost as if it's sunnah to leave when you're 62, right? So Imam al-Bukhari, being the main person behind the preservation of the sunnah, he also leaves at this age. So remember, when you're calculating from Gregorian to Hijri, every 30 years you plus one, right? So if he was 60 according to the Gregorian calendar, he'd be 62 according to the Hijri calendar. So he didn't live a very long life, right? He's not someone like Imam Malik lived to his 90s, right? Imam, the great Sahabi Anas ibn Malik lived till the age of 105. Imam al-Bukhari passed away at the age of 62. Most of his accomplishments that we're going to talk about was when he was a teenager or in his early 20s. So Imam al-Bukhari was a Farsi, he was a Persian scholar. And he spoke both Farsi and English. He spoke both Farsi and Arabic. Farsi was his home language, Persian was his home language. Arabic became the state language of the Muslim world, the official language of the Muslim world, 200 years before this, during the reign of Abdul Malik ibn Marwan. So Abdul Malik ibn Marwan, the famous Umayyad scholar, he basically turned the Muslim world into an empire, where it had its own flag, its own currency, its own language, and he made Arabic the official language. So even Muslims who would speak Farsi would have to learn Arabic to go to school or university and to become educated, right? So Imam al-Bukhari, even though he came from a Persian family, he had to learn Arabic to get educated. And by the way, in those days, because Muslims were the world's superpower, you'd find that even the Christians and Jews would learn Arabic so they could go to university and study, right? Because all the best universities in the world were in the Muslim world. So he spoke Arabic and Farsi very fluently, and one can say that Farsi was his home language and Arabic was his second language, right? But it did not in any way impact his writings and studies. I want to give us a few snapshots of his life, because I don't want to focus too much on his biography. There's some stories which are weak, some stories where there's difference of opinion on the authenticity, a lot of stories about his piety. I really want to focus on the facts that help us to understand what he wrote and why he wrote it. Right? That's what I'm going to focus on. So firstly, his father passes away when he's very young. We say his father was a merchant. And his father left behind a very large inheritance with just two inheritors, his wife and his son. So both Imam al-Bukhari and his mother inherit a lot of money. And you will see in his life story, money is never a problem. He lived a very simple life. The cost of living back then was very simple, right? There wasn't much that you needed. They had a home. They just needed money for the daily expenses, which was like just food and stuff like that. So him and his mother, they never had to worry about money. That's never a problem for Imam al-Bukhari. You know, one of the famous stories about him was that he was traveling by ship and he had a bag with 10,000 gold coins in it. And someone found out about it, so that person tried to trick him into giving him the gold, right? And Imam al-Bukhari, worried about his reputation, he literally just throws the bag into the ocean. Right? He throws into the ocean, he'd rather lose the gold than have people slander him and assume the worst of him. And the fact that he had that much money on him and throwing it away didn't affect his life in any way shows the kind of wealthy background he came from. So he lived in a time of wealth, a time of peace, a time of great success for the Muslims. And one of the things he did do some business. He did do some trade to make sure that his money never got finished. So whenever he felt like his wealth was, you know, getting a bit lower, he would do a little bit of business, he would travel for business to make sure that his money stayed at the level that he wanted it to. So he was a shrewd businessman as well, a very honest businessman who was very strong in his finances, making sure that he never fell to a level where he would have to depend on anyone for money. He was always financially independent. And that played a big role in the kind of scholar Imam Bukhari becomes. Because he's not someone who the governments can force to make certain opinions. He's not someone who you can fire from the masjid, right? He's not someone who is dependent on his teachings for money. He is a self-funded scholar, so he is independent. Imam al-Bukhari throws himself into studying the science of hadith at the age of 11. And immediately, people see him to be a man of great intelligence and memory. Now again, going back to what the world was like at that time, many people today don't realize how different Muslim society was at that time. Back then, there was no school and university as we know it, right? Once you hit puberty, you are an adult. And you'd get married and you'd live your adult life. So Imam al-Bukhari, at this age, people at the age of 11 would be starting work, they would be starting a business, or they would be going off to study Islam. He doesn't need money, so he just dedicates his life to studying Islam. And he's treated the same as any other student. No one's treating him like how we treat 11-year-olds today. Right? They're treating him as a student in the classroom. Which again, it's a different world from what we know of today. So at the age of 11, he's studying, and people immediately notice that this student is different. He doesn't take down notes, yet he never makes mistakes. He doesn't take down notes, but he never makes mistakes. People will test him by looking in their books, and he would correct them through his memory. And he's doing all of this when he's 11, 12, 13 years old. So this already is showing that this is a very gifted person. And again, some nowadays you get some people who are skeptical about this. They're saying, how can he have that good memory? How can he be that intelligent? But the reality is, every generation has people who are that intelligent and has that good memory. The problem is nowadays we don't push them to study Islam, right? Nowadays when we know someone's got that good memory and that good intelligence, none of us say, let's make him a scholar, let's make her a scholar. Instead, we want to make sure that they're studying something else. But in those days, people of this level of intelligence would study Islam, and that's why they became the kind of scholars that we don't get today. So Imam al-Bukhari was noticed for his intelligence and memory, and very soon, by the age of 14, he had memorized 600,000 narrations. 600,000 narrations by the age of 14 or 15. Now again, it's important to note the difference in terminology. Today, when we say hadith or narration, what are we referring to? We refer to the text, right? Like, every action is judged by its intention. In those days, if they said narration, they are talking about the full chain of narrators. So if Imam al-Bukhari heard the hadith that every action is judged by intentions from 20 different people, he would count it as 20 different narrations. That each chain is counted as a separate narration. So 600,000 narrations doesn't mean 600,000 hadith texts like we know today. Nor does it mean every single one of these hadiths are authentic. Rather, the genius of Imam al-Bukhari, he can have 600,000 hadiths in his head, and he can shift through them and separate the weak from the authentic and write his books accordingly. And so the 600,000, this is a number that includes repetitions, it includes weak hadiths, it's not referring to only the sahih hadith, right? So he memorizes 600,000 narrations, and he begins this project of separating them into authentic, weak, fabricated, analyzing the chains. And so very early in his life, around the age of 15 or 16, he writes a book about the biographies of the narrators of hadith. He writes this more for himself, so he can write out this narrator is authentic, this narrator is not. So he can become familiar with their names, and he can separate for himself who are the authentic narrators and who are not. And so you'll find many of the books that Imam al-Bukhari wrote were about the biographies of hadith narrators. At least 5 books he wrote were on this topic, because this was a very important work for him. It may not be important to us, but for him to get it right, for him to make sure that every hadith he narrates is sahih, then he had to do this work first. He had to memorize the hadith, he had to learn the biographies, he had to separate them and figure out who's authentic and who's not, and he had to do all of this research first before he actually writes his book. So, what was Imam al-Bukhari an expert in? Well, obviously, I think we all know he was an expert in hadith. That doesn't need to be stated, right? He wrote 2 major books of hadith and 5 major books on the narrators of hadith. So, at least 7 of his books were in the field of hadith. But Imam al-Bukhari was also a great mujtahid in the field of fiqh and a master of the field of aqidah. And this is where he gets in trouble a bit later in his life, right? Aqidah in those days gets you in a lot of trouble, because everyone's always debating on things that we don't even think about these days. Now, here there's a lot of back projection in history. A lot of people nowadays, they argue over, was Imam Bukhari a Shafi'i or a Hanbali? Right, this is the argument you hear a lot nowadays. Was he Shafi'i or Hanbali? Which madhab did he follow? And if you actually study the Sahih al-Bukhari and if you study his opinions, you will come to the conclusion that he was an independent mujtahid. He did not follow any of the known madhabs today. For multiple reasons. Number one, the madhabs back then had not formulated the way they are today. Today when we talk about the Hanbali madhab, we're talking about over 1,000 years of scholarship. When we're talking about the Hanafi madhab, we're talking about 1,000 years of scholarship. In the time of Imam Bukhari, if you're talking about the Hanbali madhab, you're literally talking about his teacher. Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal is alive at this time. Imam Bukhari is meeting with him and studying with him. So to him, that's not a madhab, that's his teacher. Right? It's a one-on-one personal relationship. And you will find that he deferred to Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal on many issues. Same with Imam Ash-Shafi. Imam Ash-Shafi is one generation before him. In those days, they're not thinking of these people as madhabs. They're thinking of them as my teachers or my teacher's teachers. It takes many years before people begin to look at it as a madhab, as a compilation of opinions from a variety of scholars who shared the same methodology. So Imam al-Bukhari was an independent mujtahid. Just to give you some examples of this, the four madhabs all say that a woman's not allowed to touch the Quran when she's on her menstrual cycles, right? Imam al-Bukhari was of the opinion that she can. Right? He was of the opinion that she can. So this clearly shows he's not following any of the four madhabs. He has his own opinions. Right? Likewise, the four madhabs have the view that a man's awra is from his navel to his knees. They differ over the knee itself and the thigh itself, but generally from the navel to the knees. Imam al-Bukhari's opinion was that a man's awra is just his private parts. That's all. So he has his own opinions in fiqh that are not found in any of the four madhabs. So he is an independent scholar on the same level as these scholars. Now what you'll find in later history is that the Shafis and Hanbalis embraced his books. So the Shafis are claiming he's a Shafi scholar and the Hanbalis are claiming he's a Hanbali scholar. And the one madhab that took the longest to embrace his books were the Hanafis. Because we'll see a bit later, Imam al-Bukhari and the Hanafi ulama were always at each other, right, at that time. They always were refuting each other. So it took the Hanafis many centuries to accept Sahih al-Bukhari as something to follow. And what you'll find in Sahih al-Bukhari is that many of the hadiths and opinions presented there are the opposite of what the Hanafi madhab teach. So the Hanafis also end up taking different positions on Imam al-Bukhari. The one that's most common today is that he thought he was a mujtahid, but he wasn't. So you don't have to take his fiqh opinion seriously. Right? This is their way of dismissing his opinions, because really, Imam al-Bukhari, when you read his commentary in Sahih al-Bukhari, he's just going after the Hanafis. Like, it's just him versus the Hanafis. Right? So they want to study the book without, you know, taking that part of it seriously. So they end up saying that he wasn't really a mujtahid on the same level as the other imams. But in reality, during his lifetime, people treated him as a proper mujtahid. People would take his opinions very seriously, and he was considered to be a scholar on a very high level. We can divide his life into four stages, right? Stage one, as a teenager and preteen, studying hadith, memorizing hadith, sorting out the narrators, and formulating his ideas of which hadith are most authentic, as well as studying fiqh and aqidah. So those were his student days as a teenager. His 20s and 30s, writing his major books. So it took him over a decade to write Sahih al-Bukhari. His Sahih was not written in 1 year. It's not an overnight production. It's over a decade of work based on over 2 decades of research. He spent a lot of time thinking over every single hadith, making dua over every single hadith, or making istikhara over every single hadith, consulting his teachers. He would take the book to Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal and ask him, what do you think of this? Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal would point out mistakes and tell him, fix this, fix that. So it's a long process. It's not just one man who wrote a book and said, here's a Sahih book, right? This is a process taking over a decade, multiple rewrites, editing, taking it to his teachers, getting their approval. Eventually, the book attains the status of the most authentic book of hadith. That this is a man who put together a book where you can trust the hadith in this book. Because until then, every book of hadith was a mixture of authentic and weak, right? And as the teacher is teaching it, they would explain which hadith is authentic and which hadith is weak. So his book becomes very famous. And then that comes the third phase of his life. What we would call today the celebrity scholar phase, right? Where Imam al-Bukhari becomes the most popular Imam in the Muslim world. Think Mufti Mank level fame. Wherever he goes, thousands of people are coming for his lectures. Wherever he goes, people want to meet him, talk to him, say they studied with him. If he was alive today, people would be taking selfies with him, right? He was like basically the celebrity scholar of the Muslim world for the next 20 years. And he travels and he teaches Sahih al-Bukhari wherever he goes. That's why there are many, many chains of narrators of Sahih al-Bukhari. Because Imam al-Bukhari had so many students wherever he went. But then we enter the final phase of his life. Remember, nobody can go through life without being tested. And Imam al-Bukhari had this, you know, a lot of ease in his life. Wealth and fame and intelligence and being good at whatever he does. At the end of his life comes one big trial that really messes up life for him. And that is the slander. You know, nowadays, whenever a scholar gets too famous, what do people do? They slander him, right? They'll take one sentence he says, and they'll make a 4-hour YouTube video about why he is an evil deviant based on that one sentence, right? So imagine, in the time of Imam al-Bukhari, there's no YouTube, there's no social media, but somehow the people do the exact same thing to him, through word of mouth. They do the exact same thing to him. So he becomes ridiculously famous. So famous that people stop studying with other scholars and go to study with him. And because of that, the other scholars now start to get jealous of him. They're sitting and teaching. In those days, what would happen was, you'd walk into a masjid, there'd be like 10 scholars teaching in different corners, and you choose who you want to study with, right? So you'll see one imam's teaching hadith, one's teaching fiqh, one's teaching aqidah, and you'll just sit there and you listen. So Imam al-Bukhari will walk into a masjid, he'll sit down and start teaching, and everybody will come by him. And so some of the other scholars, they start to get jealous. They see that their students are dwindling and everyone's going to Bukhari. So they start sending people to ask him questions, trick questions, to try and get him in trouble. Again, it seems almost like the modern world, right? Whenever someone's famous, you always get one or two people in the crowd who are just there to ask questions to get that guy in trouble, right? And people keep doing this to Imam al-Bukhari. And he's very careful in how he words his answers because he doesn't want people to spread any slander about him. He wants to make sure people are very clear about his beliefs and opinions. Now, there is one issue that was a big issue at that time, right? And that is the issue of the creation of the Quran. So just a backstory to this. About 100 years before the time of Imam al-Bukhari, the Mu'tazilite come about. And they say that the Quran is created. And the Abbasid rulers, they become Mu'tazilite themselves. And they start to imprison or kill any scholar who doesn't agree with the idea of the Quran being created. So Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, he opposes this. And eventually, later Abbasids start following him instead. And now it's flipped around. Now, everyone is following Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal's aqidah, which is that the Quran is the word of Allah. And anyone who says the Quran is created is a Mu'tazilite and a deviant, and you mustn't study with him. Which is a fair thing to say. Someone stands up in Imam al-Bukhari's lecture during the Q&A segment and asks him, is the Quran created? And Imam al-Bukhari gives a very nuanced answer, right? An answer on his level, but again, people must hear him, must understand him. And he says, the word of Allah is uncreated, but the words that come out of my mouth are created. So people hear this, or they must hear this, and they go to Imam al-Zuhayli. This is like the main famous hadith scholar besides Imam Bukhari, the one who's losing his students to Imam al-Bukhari, right? And they tell him, we just heard Imam Bukhari say the Quran is created. He said those words coming out of his mouth are created. Right? So he's saying the Quran is created. So Imam al-Zuhayli says, he says the Quran is created, must be a Mu'tazila. And so now the rumor starts spreading. Imam Bukhari is a Mu'tazila. Don't attend his lectures. Don't go for his classes. Don't narrate hadith from him. And it spreads to such an extent that Imam Bukhari starts getting boycotted by the community. To such an extent that he reaches a point where he shows up to deliver a lecture and only 8 people come for his lecture. This is a man who thousands of people are coming for his lectures, and now at the end of his life, only 8 people are showing up because the slander had done such a powerful job of ruining his reputation. People believe the slander and they stop attending his lectures, they stop inviting him to their cities and countries, they stop studying hadith with him, And this takes a mental toll on Imam al-Bukhari. If you've never been slandered, it's very difficult to explain the mental toll it takes on you. Anyone who has been in the situation knows that this is one of the most difficult trials to deal with. Where you know you are innocent, but no matter what you tell people, they won't believe you. And that's what Imam al-Bukhari is dealing with. So, in the Sahih al-Bukhari, there is a hadith where the Prophet said, none of you should ever wish for death. But if you're in that stage where you feel like, you know, you could just die now, you should make this dua, oh Allah, if life is better for me, keep me alive, and if death is better for me, take my life. So Imam al-Bukhari, being someone who practiced every hadith that he recorded, at this point where he's going through all this anguish and the slander and dealing with society hating him and believing the lies against him, he makes this dua. He says, oh Allah, if life is better for me, keep me alive, and if death is better for me, take my life. And a few days later, he's out with his family, passing through a village on horseback. He has an accident and he passes away at the age of 60. Imam al-Bukhari never lived to see just how famous his book will become. He never lived to see how accepted his book will become amongst the ummah. He passed away at a time where people hated him. He passed away at a time where people were slandering him, where people thought the worst of him. Eventually, after he passes away, the rumors die down. People start reading his book again. People realize his genius. People realize what they have their hands on. And within a few generations, the rumors are forgotten about, and Sahih al-Bukhari is now the gem of the ummah. But this happens decades after he passes away. In his life, he never got to see it. And in that, there's a lesson for us. You know, sometimes you don't see the fruit of your work in your life. It only comes later. It only comes after you have passed away. So this is the life of Imam al-Bukhari. Let's take a look now at his legacy, his accomplishments. Again, many of us only know him for one book, right? The Sahih. And rightly so, the Sahih was his masterpiece, was his greatest work, and his most important book. But he's written other important books as well. So his most famous book, which we call Sahih al-Bukhari, he did not call it Sahih al-Bukhari. He did not name a book after himself, right? So Imam al-Bukhari did not call the book Sahih al-Bukhari, Bukhari's authentic book. That's not what he called his book. He called it Al-Jami al-Sahih al-Musnad, the comprehensive authentic book of hadith with full chain of narrators. Al-Jami meaning it covers every possible topic of Islam. That's what Al-Jami means. So in Sahih al-Bukhari, you have Aqidah, you have Fiqh, you have Tafsir, you have history, you have Adab and Akhlaq, you have virtues of the Sahaba, you have other things as well, that's not coming to my mind, but it's a comprehensive book covering over 150 different topics. That's why he called it Al-Jami, the comprehensive work. As-Sahih, because his goal was to only record hadith that he believed to be Sahih. So he called it As-Sahih. And Al-Musnad means he's not just mentioning the text, he's mentioning the full chain of narrators for every hadith. So when you read this book, you will see that it covers almost every possible topic. It is, I'm going to say, 99% Sahih, right? And it has full chain of narrators for every hadith. But this is not the only book that he wrote. Imam al-Bukhari wrote another masterpiece in hadith, one that I feel is very underrated, and this is the one I think that should be in every Muslim home. Because the Sahih was written on a very advanced scholarly level, written for other scholars. His other work was written more for the average Muslim, and it's been translated into English, Al-Adab al-Mufrad. Right? Al-Adab al-Mufrad, which literally means the other book of manners. Because in the Sahih, he has Kitab al-Adab, the book of manners. But because he wanted people to learn manners, he wrote Al-Adab al-Mufrad, which means the other book of manners or another book of manners. Right? So Al-Adab al-Mufrad is a book in which Imam al-Bukhari compiles a variety of hadith and narrations of the Sahaba on manners and good character. The whole book is just manners and good character. And he doesn't use as stringent conditions for this book as he does for the Sahih. So while Sahih al-Bukhari is 99% authentic, Adab al-Mufrad is like 90% authentic. There's still 10% of the hadiths are weak, but it doesn't really matter because it's Adab, right? So for example, in the chapter on the rights of mothers, he may mention 20 hadiths on the rights of mothers. If one of those hadiths is weak, does it in any way affect the rights of mothers? No, he doesn't. It's already established through the Quran and the Sahih Hadith. So he just mentions it as supporting evidence. Right? So Al-Adab al-Mufrad isn't on the same level of authenticity as Sahih al-Bukhari, but it's an absolute gem. It's something every Muslim home should have. It's something you should teach your children, because he really covers all of the comprehensive character and manners of the Muslim in a single book. Right? So this is really a masterpiece of Imam al-Bukhari. He also wrote a lot of books on the biographies of the hadith narrators, because this helped him to separate the authentic narrators from the weak. So 5 books of his are known on in this area. And one thing about Imam al-Bukhari, you know, later scholars, they use like very fascinating names for their books, like The Shining Light or The Guiding Moon and things like that. Imam al-Bukhari had very literal names for his books. Very literal, like we say, the comprehensive authentic collection of hadith with full chain of narrators. Or the other book of manners. It's like very literal. It's the same with these books. Tariq al-Saghir, the small book of history. Tariq al-Awsat, the medium-sized book of history. Tariq al-Kabir, the big book of history. Right? Al-Quna, the books of people's nicknames. And al-Du'afa al-Saghir, the small book of weak narrators. So very literal, like when you know what Imam al-Bukhari's book is about, it's in the name. It's as literal as it gets. So these books obviously would not be of interest to us. Maybe for someone who is doing a master's in hadith or a PhD in hadith, they would want to read these kind of books. But for the average Muslim, it's not necessary to read these kind of books, right? These are very advanced level works. He also wrote one book on Aqidah to try and clarify his stance after people started slandering him, right? So when he said that the Quran is Allah's word and uncreated, but the words coming out of my mouth are created, people did not understand what he was saying and they slandered him. So he wrote a book called Khalqu Af'alul Ibad, right? The creation of human actions, where he tried to explain that human actions are created by Allah. That's what he means when he said the words coming out of my mouth are created by Allah. Right? So he wrote this book of Aqidah to clarify his stance on this issue. And he wrote, and we know of 2 books of fiqh that he wrote, thanks to our Salafi and Ahli Hadith brothers, because they translated these 2 books into English and Urdu and distributed it to every Hanafi they know. And that is the book on Raful Yadain Fi Salah, raising your hands before and after ruku in Salah, and Al-Qira'a Khalf Al-Imam, reciting Surah Fatiha behind the Imam. Right? So these books show you a very different side of Imam al-Bukhari. He's very critical of the Hanafis in these books. A very strong language. You can actually feel like a frustration between him and the Hanafis in his area. And of course, modern movements like Salafis and Ahli Hadith, they love these books, because it just bashes Hanafis, right? So I remember when I went to India for the first time, literally the first book anyone gave me was an Urdu translation of this book. They're like, you must read this book. And then somebody else gave me the English translation as well. Because, you know, for some reason, you know, these are still the big issues amongst the Ahli Hadith in India, that they want to make sure everyone's raising their hands before and after ruku and reciting behind the Imam. But these were books he wrote to clarify his opinions on these fiqh issues. I don't think he meant for them to be used the way they are used today. Nonetheless, these are the books of his that we know of. Many of his other books were lost over time, most likely in the Mongol invasion when they destroyed all the books in Baghdad. Many of the other books he wrote were lost. But these books have reached us. 4 of them have been translated into English. The Sahih al-Bukhari, Adab al-Mufrad, the raising hands before and after ruku in Salah, and reciting behind the Imam. From all of these books, the only one I would actually recommend for people to actually have in their homes and study is Adab al-Mufrad. Sahih al-Bukhari, I would recommend you study that with a scholar. Don't try reading it on your own. It's a very confusing book to read on your own, right? But this book, yeah, you can read this book on your own, you can teach it to your family. It's very straightforward, right? The chapter on don't lie, chapter on don't steal, don't swear, don't curse. It's very straightforward stuff. It's not something that's, you know, going to require scholarly explanation. The other 2 books, I don't feel they're necessary for our community, right? But, you know, if you want to understand his position on those topics, it's worth a read. So, Imam al-Bukhari, he lived in a time where there was a lot of tension between the different madhabs and groups. The madhabs were still being formulated, and people took their differences very seriously. So when one imam says you don't raise your hands before and after ruku, and another says you do, they would have back and forth arguments about it for years. And those arguments will get very heated. And that's why when you read Imam Bukhari's book on the topic, it's very heated, right? Because he's living at that time where this is like a hot topic. But for us today, you know, 1,000 years later, we don't consider that big a deal. We understand there's different madhabs, there's different approaches, all of it is acceptable. So, you know, it's not that big a deal for us. Want to end off with a discussion on the Sahih itself, right? We'll spend the last 20 minutes just focusing on the Sahih itself and its legacy and how to approach it and the mistakes people make when it comes to this book. So number one, Sahih al-Bukhari is the most authentic book of hadith any human being has ever written, right? Now there is a misconception here. The misconception here is that everything in Bukhari is 100% authentic, and if you find the hadith in Bukhari, you must follow it. Right? This is the misconception. This is wrong for so many reasons. Because there are hadiths in Sahih Bukhari that Imam Bukhari himself does not follow. Like he'll mention a hadith and he'll mention another hadith after it to show that the hadith doesn't apply anymore. Right? So there are even hadiths there that he doesn't follow. And what you will find is that the ulama throughout history, they would approach Sahih al-Bukhari as a book of authentic hadiths. But when you actually study fiqh, fiqh isn't just based on authentic hadiths. Right? There's a lot of other things to consider. What does the Quran say? How did the Sahaba understand this hadith? The Sahaba who narrated this hadith, did they practice it themselves? Right? Are there other hadiths that came later that contradicted or that abrogated? There's a lot of layers to consider. You can't just pick up Sahih al-Bukhari, find one hadith, and come up with your own fiqh opinion based on it. It's a very complex text, right? And even when it comes to authenticity, there are about 20 to 40 hadiths in Sahih al-Bukhari where the ulama have differences of opinion on whether they are authentic or not. Right? There are about 20 or 40 hadiths where the ulama have differences of opinion on whether they are authentic or not. Now, to put that in context, there are 7,563 hadiths in Sahih al-Bukhari. So if there are 20 weak hadiths in Sahih al-Bukhari, what percentage is that? 0.2. That makes it 99.8% authentic. That's as good as human effort can get. That is as good as a human effort can get. Remember, when we said that, when we spoke about the Quran last year, we said one of the miracles of the Quran is that it has no mistakes. Because it's humanly impossible to write a book with no mistakes. So if we believe it's humanly impossible to write a book with no mistakes, why then do we believe that Sahih Bukhari has no mistakes? Rather, you would say Imam al-Bukhari's book is 99.8% accurate. But it is 0.2% of human error. 0.2%. Right? Compare that to every other scholar of hadith. The average book of hadith has like a 10% or 20% weak hadith. While al-Bukhari is like 0.2%. And even at 0.2%, it doesn't affect our aqidah or fiqh in any way. It's very secondary narrations. So this book is a jami, it's a comprehensive work. It covers aqidah, fiqh, history, tafsir. So for example, the history section has been translated. It's available at the bookstore. The translation was done by Muhammad Asad. The translation is called Sahih Bukhari, the Early Years. He translated the biography section about the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Right, the Aqidah section, I'm going to give you some sample of that a bit later. And initially, this book was a Hanbali and Shafi book. So if you lived about 100 years after the time of Imam al-Bukhari, you will find it was Shafi and Hanbali ulama who were memorizing this book and teaching it. The Malikis were following the Muwatta, right? And the Hanafis, they had their own works to follow instead. It took the Hanafis the longest to get on board with Sahih al-Bukhari because there was, again, as I said, in his lifetime, he and the Hanafis had a lot of tension between them. So that tension lasted for a few hundred years. They didn't really forget it till much later. Really, we can thank Shah Waliullah Dehlawi for bringing Sahih al-Bukhari into the Indian Hanafi circle and making it normalized to study and to follow, not really to follow, but to study and to respect and give that status to Sahih al-Bukhari. In fact, today, almost every chain of narrators of Sahih al-Bukhari that we have goes back through Shah Waliullah al-Dehlawi. Even those who study in Saudi Arabia, the chain of narrators still go back to him, through the Indian ulama, right? Because he's the one who revived the study of this book. So Sahih al-Bukhari is one of the six main books of hadith from which we derive our aqidah and fiqh. Another misconception people have is that if a hadith is not in Bukhari, it's not authentic. Right? This is a misconception. There are many authentic hadiths that are not in Bukhari. You can find them in Sahih Muslim, in Abu Dawood, in Tirmidhi, in the Musnad Imam Ahmad, in the Muwatta Imam Malik. His book, he didn't write it to include every single authentic hadith. He just wrote it to include those authentic hadiths that supported his opinions, right? Or that he felt were most authentic. So there are many authentic hadiths that he did not mention in his book because he wrote it with a specific purpose in mind. So this doesn't mean that there are 7,500 authentic hadiths. In reality, there's more like 20,000 authentic hadiths. Right? There's like 20,000 authentic hadiths. 7,000 can be found in Sahih al-Bukhari, others can be found in Sahih Muslim and in all these other books as well. The six main books of hadith were written primarily by Imam al-Bukhari and his students. So Imam Muslim was his student. Abu Dawood was his student. Tirmidhi was his student. So four out of the six books were written by Imam Bukhari and his students. And then the other two written a generation later by An-Nasa'i and Ibn Majah. Now, nowadays we have this problem that people try to open a translation of Sahih al-Bukhari and derive their own fiqh and aqidah from that. And that is an absolute mess when people do that. Why? Because these individuals do not understand what Bukhari's book is and how it's supposed to be studied. This isn't a book that the layman can open a translation of and do their own ijtihad. This is a very, very advanced work. Right? Historically, Bukhari was a last year subject. Like even right till today, in the Alimiya program, you study, you're introduced to Sahih Bukhari in your final year. Why don't they do Sahih Bukhari in the first year or in the second year? Because it's an advanced work. You need to learn Arabic, you need to learn fiqh, you need to learn the methodology of hadith analysis, you need to study smaller books of hadith, and then only can you actually appreciate Sahih al-Bukhari. But if you just dive into this book first, you're not going to understand it. So right till today, you will find that this is a final year subject. You're only introduced to it in your final year, and really you only truly understand it many years later. Like it took me 10 years to really begin to understand the genius behind Imam al-Bukhari's writings. So what happened in the modern world is that we have these movements to where people believe you can just follow Quran and Hadith and interpret it as you want. And these are the movements that translated Sahih al-Bukhari and told people, no, just follow Quran and Bukhari, you don't need to follow anything else. Right? And so people with absolutely no knowledge of Usul al-Fiqh are opening up Bukhari and coming up with their own very, very random understandings of Aqidah and Fiqh from it. Because they do not have the background knowledge to interpret this book properly. This book cannot be understood on its own. Why? Well, number one, there are narrations in this book where there's a difference of opinion on whether it's authentic or weak. Right? There are at least 20 narrations in this book where some people say they are weak. Then there are those hadiths that are abrogated. Like I remember once I met one of these guys who was reading Bukhari's translation to make his own fiqh. And he started going around telling everybody that ghusl on a Friday is wajib. If you don't make ghusl on a Friday, then your Jummah is not valid. And he based this on a Sahih hadith in Bukhari. Because there is a hadith in Bukhari that states that Jummah is not valid if you do not make ghusl. But Imam al-Bukhari in his explanation explains that hadith is abrogated. That hadith, the Prophet ﷺ, he said that early in Medina. Right? And once people got used to cleanliness, he abrogated it. And he said that those of you who have ghusl on a Friday, that's good. Those of you who do it, that's good. So yes, the hadith is there. But it's abrogated. Now if you don't even know what abrogation is, and if you're not a scholar, you're going to see the hadith and you're going to misinterpret it and come up with wrong fiqh. Then there are hadiths that are explained by other hadiths. Imam Bukhari may bring a hadith, Imam Muslim may bring another hadith that helps you to understand it better. But if you're only reading Bukhari and not Muslim, you're going to end up misunderstanding the hadith in Bukhari. Right? So, and then there are also hadiths which are not considered revelation. Right? There are certain hadiths where the Prophet ﷺ is giving his own opinion. And Imam al-Bukhari might have understood it like that. The commentator in Bukhari might have understood it like that. But the average layman reading it today will think it's revelation and feels like you have to follow it. Right? So for example, the hadith on medicine. A lot of the hadith on medicine in Bukhari were the Prophet talking about the medical knowledge available in Medina at that time. So when the Prophet said that there's no contagion, we know this Sahih hadith caused a lot of problems in the past 3 years, right? When the Prophet said there's no contagion, so people now start believing that nothing's contagious. Well, that hadith is not a revelation type of hadith. It's him talking about the knowledge available in Medina at that time, right? And there are later hadiths where he changes the view, and where he did say that, you know, he told people not to enter a land where there's a plague, showing he did change his opinion on that later. So hadiths on medicine are not necessarily revelation. Many people don't know that. Other issues as well. So there may be a hadith in Bukhari that says that the Prophet ﷺ ate locusts. Does that mean to follow the sunnah we all must go and buy some fried locusts? No, that's his personal taste. It's not sunnah, you don't have to follow it, right? Finally, the biggest mistake people make when reading Bukhari is that they think it's only a book of hadith. And they are completely unaware of the fact that in the chapter headings, he is giving his commentary, he's giving his opinions, he's quoting Quran, he's quoting the Sahaba. And one of the reasons why this happens is, this part of Sahih al-Bukhari has not been translated. And I want us to take a look at the example to show you just how badly we must read and must understand Bukhari, right? Let's look at an example. So, the website sunnah.com is the best website for translations of the books of hadith. All the major books of hadith are translated on this website. Any book of hadith you want to access, you can get it from sunnah.com. So I open sunnah.com, which has the best translation of Bukhari, and I open to chapter 2, the book of Aqidah, the book of Iman. And right at the bottom, you can see the first hadith, right? But do you all notice what's going on over here? This whole section, the whole introduction is not translated at all. Not at all. There's no translation of this. And you know what's going on here? Imam al-Bukhari is stating his opinions on Aqidah. He is debating the Hanafis. He's refuting them. He's quoting Quran. He's quoting Sahaba. And all of this is missing. So for the average person reading a translation, they will see this chapter heading. They will see this hadith. They might not understand how the hadith relates to the chapter heading or why Imam Bukhari is bringing it here, because all of this information is missing. All this information is missing. It's like, literally, this is the translation of Bukhari, but throughout the translation, every time we have Imam al-Bukhari's explanation, it's not translated. And that makes it very dangerous for the reader, that you're not getting the full context of why he is saying this hadith and why he's bringing it in this chapter. Like, this section here would take 2 hours to explain. And it gives you a glimpse into the actual aqidah of Imam al-Bukhari. So for example, he says here that iman huwa qawl wal fi'l. Iman is your speech and your actions. Here he's refuting the idea that iman is only speech, right? So in that time there was this idea that if you say la ilaha illallah, you're a Muslim. Doesn't matter what you do. And Imam Bukhari is saying, no, it's speech and actions. You have to believe and you have to do good deeds. Right? Then he says, وَيَزِيدُ وَيَنْكُسْ. It increases and decreases. So Imam Abu Hanifa was of the opinion that iman does not increase and decrease, it's your piety that increases and decreases. And Imam Bukhari is saying, no, iman itself increases and decreases. So there's a theological debate going on between Imam Abu Hanifa and Imam Bukhari in the first 5 words over here. And this entire thing is completely missed out from someone reading a translation, because none of this has been translated. And I think even if it was translated, you wouldn't understand what he's talking about without context of who he's talking about and what were the debates going on during his lifetime. And then he brings all of these verses. These are all verses of the Quran. All Quranic verses that he brings to explain his opinion. Then he brings up another opinion of his in Aqidah. وَالْحُبُّ فِي اللَّهِ وَالْبُغْدُ فِي اللَّهِ مِنَ الْإِيمَانِ. Loving for Allah and hating from Allah is part of Iman. Right? So he's teaching us his Aqidah. He's teaching us his opinions on these issues of Aqidah that people were arguing over. And then he quotes Umar bin Abdul Aziz as evidence. He quotes Mu'adh ibn Jabal, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. All of this is missing in the translation. Another example. Any chapter you open of Sahih Bukhari, of a translation, all of this is missing. So here's another example. Right, in chapter 10, well, nothing's translated. Right, because there's chapter 10 heading, then there's all this Arabic, and then there's the chapter 11 heading. So the entire section here is not translated. And what is going on in this section? He quotes Quran, right? A lot of Quran. All of this is Quran. Then he quotes a hadith without mentioning the chain of narrators. Now, when Imam Bukhari doesn't mention the chain of narrators, then there's three possibilities. A, he thinks the hadith is weak. B, he's just using it as secondary evidence. Or C, he already mentioned the chain of narrators somewhere else in the book, so he doesn't feel the need to bring it again. But there's literally a hadith over here, may yuridullah bi khayran yufaqihu fi din, and this hadith is not translated. Whoever Allah intends good for, he gives him the correct understanding of the religion. This hadith is not translated. It's right here, but it's not translated. Then there's a quotation from Abu Dharr, also not translated. A quotation from Abdullah ibn Abbas, also not translated. So what happens now for someone who just picks up a translation and trying to understand, you know, make up their own interpretation of it? What's going to happen? Entire chapters, you're not going to know what's going on, right? Because all of this is missing. And I also think even if you translate this, it's not going to be understood by the average person. Because this is very advanced level discussions going on here. Right? This is Imam al-Bukhari debating with Imam Abu Hanifa. Most of us are not on the level of Imam Bukhari or Imam Abu Hanifa. We don't know the context of that time and why these were issues that were important to them, and why, what was Imam Abu Hanifa's evidence, what was Imam Bukhari's evidence, why are they discussing this issue, right? Or even what the opinions are. So this whole section would even be missing. Even if it was translated, people wouldn't understand it, or why Imam Bukhari is bringing it here. So a large segment of the book, his opinions, his commentary, quotations from the Sahaba, verses of the Quran, and even some of the hadiths are not translated, because they're all in the chapter headings. And that makes it very dangerous for someone to just pick up a translation and try and interpret it on their own. So today we find two major fitnas coming from people who are trying to read Sahih Bukhari on their own. Fitna A, they become extremists. Right? Almost everybody I know who became a ISIS type of person, they read the translation of Sahih Bukhari, and they read there that the Prophet said we must kill all the kuffar, or we must fight the disbelievers till they believe, and they went off and joined ISIS. Right? Just taking hadiths out of context. Or the opposite fitna, they become hadith rejectors, or they end up doubting Islam itself. So often when someone has doubts about Islam, they come to me and say, this hadith is in Bukhari, it doesn't make any sense. Islam can't be true. Hold on, one hadith doesn't make sense to you, so you're saying Islam can't be true. First, relax, calm down, read the commentary, see what the scholars had to say, check if it's authentic or not. Don't reject the whole of Islam because you read one hadith and you didn't understand it. But this is happening a lot with our youth. A lot of our youth, they'll open Sahih Bukhari, they'll find a single hadith that they don't understand, and they'll doubt all of Islam based on that hadith. Right? So we can conclude by saying, Imam al-Bukhari was the greatest hadith scholar of his generation and perhaps of all time. An absolute legend, a genius, an intelligent individual with a super sharp memory, who was very meticulous in his methodology of research and writing. His magnum opus, Al-Jami al-Sahih, is the peak of hadith scholarship. Right? Humans cannot reach 100% perfection. Sahih Bukhari is 99.8% perfection. The best that a human can produce. But even a scholar of his caliber will face trials in life. And he had to deal with the trial of the great slander. So why should any of us think that we'll go through life without being tested? And it's important for us to understand that the Sahih was meant to be for the ulama. It was meant to be a scholarly work studied at a high level. It's not meant to be a regular book that you just read and you try and interpret as you wish. Doing so can lead people to even doubting Islam and hadith, as we are seeing happening in our times. So I want to end by saying, the average Muslim should take one of three positions towards Sahih al-Bukhari. Position A, you accept that it's an advanced scholarly work, and you leave it for the ulama. Right? You don't get involved with it. Position B, if you really want to understand it, go and study and become a scholar, and then study Sahih Bukhari. Right? Like if you really, really want to dive deep into this book, become a scholar. And position number three, if you want a basic understanding of the book, don't read it on your own, study it with ulama. Find a teacher who understands the book, who has studied the book, who understands the methodology of Imam al-Bukhari, and sit with that teacher and study with the teacher. Don't try and study it on your own. It's not a book that's meant to be read on one's own. Right? So these are the three positions that I would recommend towards the specific book. And alhamdulillah, with that, we come to the end of today's presentation, and we'll open the floor to Q&A. So that anyone have any questions related to Imam Al-Bukhari, his books, the Sahih itself, any hadith that are found in it, or anything of that nature, you can ask now.
The short preamble that you mentioned that were not translated by at all the same parties. Is there someone who is intending to do that, give more clarity as to what discussions were carried on before the next hadith that he quoted?
In English, there is a project ongoing at the moment to translate and explain all of this. But that's going to take a few years, right? That is being done. In Arabic, many, many books were written. Like Ibn Hajar Asqalani's masterpiece, Al-Fathul Bari, which I have here, it's this size, right? It's an explanation of all that. So he basically spent his whole life just explaining Sahih al-Bukhari. Because it's a very complex book. The hadiths are complex. Some of the hadiths are very difficult to understand. Or sometimes it's difficult to understand why Imam Bukhari is putting this hadith in this section. Like, the chapter header will be something and the hadith will be something completely different. So Ibn Hajar explains all of it. And for me, whenever I'm confused on a hadith in Sahih Bukhari, I just open Ibn Hajar's book and I read his explanation. And 90% of the time it solves it. Right? Because he was actually very critical in his methodology. Like, he would sometimes say, this hadith makes no sense. Right? He would say that this hadith makes no sense, and I'm not sure why Imam Bukhari put it in this chapter. So he'd be very honest in his book. So in Arabic you have that. In English, it's not available yet. Because Bukhari itself was just translated in the past 2 decades, right? And now we're realizing that's not enough. So now people are working on the projects of translating all of this and writing commentaries, and that's going to take maybe a few decades to get done.
Is it safe to translate?
So that's a good question. Is it safe to translate? I'm of the opinion that most books of hadith and tafsir should never be translated into any language. Because you need to understand Arabic to understand it. Right? A lot of these things, they just wouldn't make sense in English. Like, one word in Arabic would require 2 lines of explanation in English. And then some of it's lost. So, I believe a lot of these things shouldn't be translated. Rather, if people want to study them, they should build themselves up to the level of scholarship where they can read the Arabic. Because these books are not necessary for practicing Islam. To be a Muslim, to pray 5 times a day, to follow the 5 pillars, to just be a good Muslim, you don't need to memorize Sahih al-Bukhari. You don't need to read Tafsir al-Qurtubi. You don't need to read Tafsir al-Tabari. You don't. These are advanced works for understanding Islam deeper. You just need to know your basic fiqh and aqidah, learn some hadith on manners and good character, learn to purify your soul. That's it. Islam is simple. Right? These works were written for scholars. They were written on a scholarly level. So, I personally don't like the idea of translating it. You see, one of the other problems I didn't mention is, because Bukhari was translated to English, we now have all these websites by Islamophobes pointing out 1,000 things wrong with Bukhari. And from there, in their view, 1,000 things wrong with Islam. Right? People weren't doing that in Imam Bukhari's time or afterwards because the books were only available to ulama. Right? Now, it's not to say that they're right in saying what they're saying, but for the average Muslim who doesn't understand Bukhari, they come across these Islamophobic websites and it shakes their iman. Right? When they find hadiths there which to them don't make sense or are poorly translated or taken out of context, it literally shakes the iman of the average Muslim. So, translation is a very tricky thing. Should we translate? Should we leave it in Arabic? Lots of differences of opinion on that. I personally think that having these books only in Arabic is a safe way of making sure only someone who is specialized is actually going to read it, rather than somebody reading something above the level.
If Bukhari is meant more for advanced level and scholars, like for the average Muslim, which is a good
combination of religion? Like, is it the other Salimin? Yeah, it's an excellent question, right? So, remember, in every science, you have beginner books, intermediary books, and advanced books. Hadith is the same. So we put a Bukhari right at advanced level, right? Beginner books, a book that every Muslim should study and every Muslim should have copies of. I'll name 4. Number 1, the 40 hadiths of Imam An-Nawawi. Right? The 40 hadiths, which actually 42 hadiths of Imam An-Nawawi. That's a book every Muslim home should have, every family should study, you should teach it to your children. Imam An-Nawawi chose 42 hadiths that he feels summarize the religion. And if you learn those 42 hadiths, you essentially know Islam. So that should be number one, the 40 hadith of Imam An-Nawawi. Number two, I would say Ash-Shamail Tirmizi. Right? The book of Imam At-Tirmizi describing the Prophet ﷺ. Again, that book doesn't go into fiqh and aqidah. It describes how the Prophet ﷺ looked. It described his acts of worship. It described his character and personality. Reading the translation of that book makes you fall in love with the Prophet ﷺ. It increases your iman. It's a very beautiful book that every Muslim home should have and should study. Number three would be again Imam Nawawi, his other major work, Riyadus Salihin. Again, Riyadus Salihin doesn't go into the advanced fiqh and aqidah. It focuses on manners, character, purification of the soul, daily ethics. You can read it, you can understand it. And number four, since we all love Imam Bukhari and we want one of his books on our shelves, this is a good book that every Muslim home should have, right? Al-Adab al-Mufrad by Imam al-Bukhari. I truly believe this is a book that we should have and we should teach our children. Because this is a comprehensive work on all the manners and characters of a good Muslim. And it takes you on a journey of character. Like the first 10 chapters is on being good to your mother. The next 10 chapters is on being good to your father. The next 10 chapters is on maintaining family ties. Right? It takes you on a journey of priority, of what's the most important levels of character. So teaching this book to our families is very important. So if we want to study Bukhari in our homes by ourselves, don't study the Sahih, that you should study with teachers, but study Adab al-Mufrad instead. Right? This is and this book has been translated into English. A commentary on it has also been translated into English. So it's very accessible. So those are the four books I would recommend to start, right? An-Nawawi's 40 Hadiths, Adab al-Mufrad, Riyadus Salihin, and Shamail at-Tirmizi. Those four books, every Muslim home should have a translation of it. Read it, get your kids to read it, study it as a family. That will help you to learn the main hadith that you need to be a good Muslim. Right? Those are like the most important hadiths. You'll find it in those four books. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah, so two points there. Number one, those people who were reciting Bukhari, you're talking about the practice of reciting Bukhari for barakah or to get the chain of narrators going back to the Prophet ﷺ. Number one, they're reciting it with a teacher, right? They have a teacher. And most of the time, the teacher would be the local expert on Bukhari, most of the time, right? Sometimes they're learning from someone else who just memorized it, right? Number two, the people you're talking about were people who followed their madhab very staunchly. They weren't in deriving their own fiqh and aqidah from Bukhari. They understood that as laymen, we're not going to try and make our own ijtihad based on these hadiths. Right? So if someone's reading Bukhari in that way, that's why I say study with a teacher, that's fine. But what we're having today is you have a guy who's like 16 years old with no training in Islam, opening Bukhari and deriving his own fatwas on Bukhari. That's the dangerous part. When you don't know the limits, your limits, that I don't know usul al-fiqh, I don't know Arabic, I don't know how to interpret hadith. So what? I don't have any business trying to derive fiqh from hadith, right? So if someone is firm in following their madhab or their teachers, and they're studying Bukhari because they want the chain of narrators, or because they want to study the sections specifically on akhlaq and adab and purification of the soul or history or tafsir, all of that's fine. My main point is, don't try to interpret the book yourself. That's my point.
So you can recite it for barakah.
That's fine. Right, reciting it for barakah, I know if you're trying to trick me to say it's a bidah or not, but no, it's fine. It's fine, inshallah. I say there's always someone in the audience who asks the trick questions. No, it is a practice, it's a practice rital today. Like, I mean, what's the main reason Hanafis study Bukhari? They don't follow it. It's for barakah and to get that chain of narrators. That's why we studied it. For barakah and to get the chain of narrators. That we have chain of narrators going back to the Prophet ﷺ through Imam al-Bukhari. But really, Hanafis don't follow most of the fiqh in Bukhari. They don't. Even though they study the book. So, it's really studied more for barakah than for anything else. Well, it was an important question, yeah? Talk.
Sorry if I missed it at the beginning, but just a question on the rigor which Imam Bukhari related the hadith. I remember hearing a story, you probably commented from the Masjid about how he spent time with the narrators, and like one of the narrators might have been ill treating an animal or something, and he discarded it because of that. Is that authentic?
I don't know if it's authentic or not. There are many stories like that about Imam al-Bukhari, and most of them are authentic, but I don't know specifically about that specific one. But he was very strict that if he found his teachers doing anything that would ruin their reputation, he wouldn't want to include that person in his book, right? Because he wanted to make sure that the chain of narrators had like the best of each generation only. So like if you read the hadith of Bukhari and you read the chain of scholars, like every scholar that he quotes is like the best scholars of that generation. People who had the best reputations. So he was very strict about if somebody had a bad reputation for anything, he wouldn't want to include them in the book. That much is true. But I know about the specific story. Right? Any other questions? Khair, inshallah. So it's a very beneficial discussion, and I hope that you all was able to get a glimpse into the genius of Imam al-Bukhari.
JazakAllah khair to Sheikh Kamda for a very beautiful session on the hadith at Imam Bukhari. Just some background, the Islamic Forum has been having these halaqa on Friday evenings for many years. For this year, this is the first session for this year, and we plan to have every Friday evening. At the moment, it will be 7:45, but we'll adjust the time as the season changes. Maybe after Isha, when Isha gets earlier. But it's going to be every alternate week, and one session will be done by Sheikh Hamda. But we also have Sheikh Ashraf Nasser, who will be doing Quran halqa on the alternate. So that will be once a month. Sheikh Kamla and once a month Sheikh Ashraf. You're invited to join with your families. But also in between for the other Fridays, we plan to have a youth halqa where it's focused on teenagers, and we will circulate details about that. Those are specifically for teenagers and youth. Isha will be performed in a few minutes outside on the balcony, and JazakAllah for your attendance.
Jazakallah khairan wa akhir da'wana alhamdulillah rabbil alamin assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.